Music session number 10641, Reel 1.
Mr. Noble, Reel 1, can you tell me when and how you came to be in the army in the first place?
Yes. I was, of course, young when the war started. I was still at school when the war started. So it's pretty obvious I was going to be in the war anyway. And I had always hoped to go to Sandhurst. But with the war, that became difficult. I enlisted into what was called the Y scheme, which was a cadet entry for the Royal Army Corps. But that was taking so long that finally I volunteered for a young soldiers battalion, 70th battalions. They were specifically for young soldiers prior to call up, and were home defence battalions. And I enlisted into the 7th. Battalion of the Queen's Royal Regiment.
How did you come to be a parachutist then?
Well, before I actually joined the battalion, while I was still doing my basic training at the Infantry Training Centre at Maidstone, I was selected for officer training and went to officer training school at Morecambe, 163 Octure at Morecambe. Whilst there, I got excited about parachuting and so on, and volunteered for parachuting. And in fact, six of us, of the number who had volunteered, were the first six to be commissioned directly into the parachute regiment.
Can you tell me a little bit about the background and history of your parachute regiment?
Yes. I went as I was commissioned and did my parachute training very quickly, so that by May 43 I was en route, although I was only 19 years old at the time, I was en route for North Africa as a reinforcement for 1st Airborne Division. About that time the war in North Africa finished, and so when I arrived in North Africa I joined 1st Airborne Division, and I as a reinforcement for what was then 156 Battalion. This was an interesting battalion because during November 1941 in India, a number of some 700 odd officers and soldiers were selected from the infantry regiments serving in India, and they formed what was 151 Parachute Battalion then in India, and they trained under extraordinarily primitive conditions. They only had cotton parachutes, they only had very clapped out old aircraft, not even like the Wellingtons that we had in the UK. They had a number of casualties from that sort of thing, but mostly, of course, all the soldiers were regular soldiers, and so were the officers, regular officers, because they'd been trapped by the war in India. They didn't stay in India. In 1942-ish, towards the end, they went to the Middle East and became 156 Battalion. They collected a number of 8th Army men in the Middle East and came on to join 1st Airborne Division as part of the 4th Parachute Brigade, which was commanded by Brigadier Hackett, who eventually, of course, became General Sir John Hackett, probably the most famous and distinguished soldier scientist the British Army's had. So what we had then at that time in April 43, May 43, was a battalion which was largely composed of ex-regular soldiers, or regular soldiers, who'd been abroad a large number of years, or men who'd been early in the desert campaign. And in fact, it was a battalion which still wore the bush hat instead of the red berry, and so on, and was very individualistic. About that time, it was introduced that men who'd been abroad more than, I think it was 6 or 7 years, were repatriated to the UK. And that applied to about 50% of the battalion. My own company commander had been abroad 13 years without ever going back to the UK, having been trapped by the war in India, and most of the men. And so suddenly the battalion went overnight from, I don't know, 700 or 800 men down to about 400 men, and we reinforcements were put in to make that number up. But of course the result was that the battalion lost all its senior, a lot of its senior officers, experienced subalterns or captain level, and all the warrant officers and sergeants and specialist men.
How did you take to being a parachutist?
Oh, that was all right. No problem at all. The personally, I would never have... I'm not very good at personal details there, that if I'd been requested to pack my own parachute, I could never have become a parachutist, as they do in some armies. And I'm not very good at being large and normally overweight. I'm not very good at sort of gymnastic things that parachutists are supposed to do, forward and back drills and so on. But I always had luck, and in some 10 years of army parachuting, I never suffered an injury. I think as far as joining the battalions were concerned, I personally, at that age, 19, had a great awe of men who had been soldiers for a much longer period, particularly before the war, or had been through the Dunkirk period, and so on. And men who'd parachuted from 1940 onwards, when the parachute forces were formed. So I felt that to join this club was, I don't know if ego is the right word, but it's certainly, I felt proud to be in the same circle as these other men. My own colonel was Sir Richard Devoe, a baronet who was a Grenadier Guardsman, and of course was probably at least 31 years old at that time, and sort of very elderly, and a very experienced soldier. He, in fact, I think he'd been adjutant of the 1st Battalion Grenadier Guards, and had virtually designed the 1937 drill book, as a result of which he brought his RSM with him, and a number of other of the senior NCOs were ex-grenadiers.
So you felt you were joining an elite force, did you?
Yes, very much so.
Did parachutists tend to be small men?
I don't think so particularly. I think we had the full range of people. I think they were always fit men, and they were always men of some personal initiative and stature and standing. I did notice towards the end of the war that the calibre of man that was joining us was not like the early volunteers, who were all men above men, I think. By the end of the war, and certainly in Palestine after the war in 1946-47, the men weren't, in my opinion, the same calibre as they were before. And probably that was true of the reinforcements we had when we got back to England in early 44 for Arnhem, which turned out to be for Arnhem in October 44.
What did being battalion MMG officer involve?
Well, one commanded the machine gun platoon, the medium machine gun platoon. At that time we had four Vickers guns in two sections, each of two guns. Each section was commanded by a sergeant. And in a parachute battalion, you must, and especially as we were organised in North Africa and through the Italian campaign and so on, and eventually even at Arnhem, we had virtually no transport, so that everything was carried on our backs. The anti-tank guns that we had in Italy were Italian breeder guns, captured solid shot breeder guns, which were hauled along by men pulling drag ropes. And the it's same with the mortar platoon, which was a very heavy loads, were carried by small sometimes, but tough men. And the machine gun platoon was the same. We carried everything on our backs, so that frequently men would be carrying more than their own weight on their own back. Number one would carry the gun, number two the tripod, number three would carry the water can and various other bits and pieces, and one or two cans of ammunition, and numbers four, five and six would carry belts of ammunition, probably three belts of ammunition each. Of course, our sergeants were often working in support of rifle companies, and so they were quite independent. It wasn't often that, as a platoon commander, I had the pleasure of commanding the platoon together in action. They were usually split up on detachment. Although the first time we went into action, I did command the platoon, and that was really probably the most terrifying moment of my life.
Can you tell me about it?
Yes. What had happened was that we were in billets in Sousse, and this was June, July, August 1943. The battalion had lost these enormous drafts of men going home, and in fact there was a plan to send the division back to the United Kingdom. And we had handed in our G1098 and all our heavy weapons, etc. And I was a rifle platoon commander, a very innocent young rifle platoon commander. At that moment, we are suddenly ordered to go for Italy and to land at Taranto. Hastily, the machine gun platoon was reformed. I was detailed to command it, having never even seen a Vickers gun before in my life. And we had 48 hours to draw up the machine guns, draw up the ammunition, draw up all the equipment, collect men who were sent across from rifle companies and headquarter company who perhaps had had some previous experience in machine gun. We had only 48 hours to do that, and in fact, as we were jumping on the trucks to drive from Sousse to Bizerta, men were still coming and joining the platoon. Fortunately, my platoon sergeant and the two section sergeants and about half the men had been experienced machine gunners, either in the Cheshire Regiment or Middlesex Regiment, but in India. So they knew all about it. But we arrived in Bizerta on several lorries and finally managed to collect the platoon together. We got on the decks of cruisers. I was on HMS Aurora. And we set sail for Italy, and I still collected my platoon about me. It was interesting that as we sailed towards Italy, we're towards Taranto, and remember, at that precise moment, we were still at war with Italy. On the horizon was suddenly seen the Italian battle fleet, and the sailors got all excited and said, "Jolly good show, we're going to have a sea battle," and they all retired into their turrets behind X inches of armour plating, and there was no room for us below deck, so we stood about on the decks, and I was sort of briefing the men on how to fire their rifles at sort of battle wagons at about 10,000 yards or something, and lay flat if the shelling started. Happily, the Italian fleet was on its way to surrender to Malta and went sailing by, and the sailors came out all disgruntled and very upset because they hadn't been involved. We were rather pleased. We finally arrived in Taranto and sailed into the harbour and landed just as night fell, and at that, about the same time Italy surrendered and the surrender document was signed. So the next day we were flogging up the road on an approach to combat role, and the Germans were very light on the ground around Taranto, and they were tending to withdraw. We just had occasional forays or sporadic attacks or shellings. On about the second day, we approached a town of Motola, and but the battalion was very strung out at that time, and there were no communications worked. We had no wireless set, and we were halted by some gunfire on the edge of a vineyard, out of touch with virtually anybody. So I went up the road to the battalion headquarters, and the adjutant told me that C Company was going to put in an attack on Motola, but he wasn't quite sure when, but I was to give them cover and support. He didn't know any of the details, when they were going to do it, where they were going from, where they were, or anything. So I went back down the road, which was about 1,000, 2,000 yards away, under some sporadic shell fire, and told my platoon sergeant this, and he got the guns lined up. And we looked towards Motala, and we looked at some figures, but we couldn't make out whether they were British or German or what, or Italian. And eventually the gun numbers were all ready, and they all had their hands up for me to say, open fire. And I didn't... this was the first time I'd seen the machine gun platoon. I'd only been in command of the platoon for about, by this time, 5 days. And I thought, my goodness, if I open fire now and I'm firing on our own troops, and I can't tell the difference through my binoculars, but if I don't, there's all these people looking at me, waiting for me to give the order. And so I rather cowardly said, fire, and they opened fire. And I really didn't quite know whether I was sunk or won. In fact, later on, we heard that the figures we had seen were, in fact, C Company, who were scrambling forward and were pinned down a bit. And we heard from a German prisoner that the machine gun fire was deadly. And but it really was, by the grace of God, and a hell of a lot of luck, as far as I personally was concerned.
Did you see much other action in Italy?
Not really, because the Germans were retiring. It was mainly patrol work and that sort of thing. We went into action once or twice, but not really very seriously. And the 10th Battalion on our right. The one thing which interested me to some extent was that just before we sailed, we were suddenly joined by some naval parachutists, and they turned out to be forward observation officer party who'd been trained in parachuting, and they were going to support us with the guns of the fleet. They joined us, but they, in fact, we had, once we'd gone about 10 or 15 miles, we were out of range of the fleet guns, and we had no support other than our own limited artillery. It was so limited that the battalion had none, and an old Italian gun, which had been outside an Italian war museum, was found to be workable. And one of our officers and some of the men who'd been in the artillery managed to get this thing workable. It was from, I think, pre-First World War. And it was amusing that they had this gun down near battalion headquarters, and it would open fire, and the officer would rush up the road in a jeep, and we could almost see the shell in overhead before it landed vaguely where the enemy was supposed to be. And then he would spot the fall of the shell and then rush back down the road in the jeep again. None of the wireless sets worked properly. But that was our main support. But it wasn't really heavy warfare in any shape or form. There's one amusing incident when three Luftwaffe officers came belting through our front lines in a typical Luftwaffe staff car, rather, as you can imagine, RAF officers. And they must have come through the German lines, and the German infantry probably waved them down, but being Air Force people, they'd sort of ignored them and waved them off. And so they were on their way down for a night out in Taranto, in the night spots of Taranto, and they hadn't realised the Allies had landed. And they came belting down through their own lines, straight through our front lines, so fast that we couldn't stop them. And they finally got stopped back in brigade headquarters and were astonished to find that they were now prisoners of war well behind the Allied line.
Can we go on to Arnhem now, and can you tell me how you first came to be involved in the Arnhem Drop?
Well, we left Italy in about December 44 and returned to the United Kingdom. And we thought we were being prepared for the D-Day invasion, and a number of exercises took place right up to the June in England. And in fact, what happened, of course, was that 6th Airborne went in on the D-Day invasion. We were kept by as standby reserves and were briefed, up to 17, I believe, other operations were planned, support operations, either in France or Belgium and so on, for the forces in Europe. owing to the changes on the battlefield, perhaps the Americans or people advanced too quickly and so on, we were never ever used, although once or twice we did get as far as getting to the aircraft. The result was that by the time Arnhem came along in September, end of September, the whole division, and particularly our battalion, were really rather bored and anxious to get into action, and almost a malaise existed. There had been about a week or so, 10 days before, the last flap, if you wish, before Arnhem was a similar operation, but the British were going to drop on the three bridges. In the Arnhem operation, it was the two Americans on the first two bridges and the British First Airborne on the third bridge over the Rhine. But the previous operation had been that we were, the division was going to drop on all three bridges. So there it was. By the time the actual Arnhem operation came along, we were very willing and eager to get into battle. We thought the war was nearly over, we were being left out of it, and we wanted to get there. I think the standard of the troops was that although we'd had a lot of training, and we'd had this lot of reinforcements, particularly our battalion, perhaps more than some of the other battalions, because of this influence of having been in India and the Middle East, and our best men having been taken away and reinforced, had come in who weren't perhaps the same calibre, and so we'd had intensive training, but then the problems of the hanging around waiting to go and waiting to go and waiting to go, I think had caused some, not a drop in morale, but perhaps a drop in the effectiveness of the battalion, not in efficiency, but the effectiveness of the battalion.
What's the difference?
Well, people can be efficient, but they don't necessarily achieve the task of effectiveness.
Can you tell me how much you were briefed before you went?
Well briefed. We're very well briefed with plans and maps and so forth and so on. But remember, I was at a battalion level. As a specialist platoon commander, I did sit in on the battalion O groups, which is, if I'd been a rifle platoon commander, I wouldn't. The company commander would have gone to the battalion O groups, and the platoon commanders would have received their orders from the company commander. But I, being a specialist platoon commander, went to the battalion O group, so I heard everything that the colonel knew, presumably.
What was your opinion of the scheme before you actually went into action? Were you confident about it?
I think we were confident. I think at platoon level we were completely confident. Because we had this strong impression that the war was virtually over, we had been given the impression that the enemy resistance would be not very strong. We had tremendous faith in the air support that the Royal Air Force could give us. We were a littlest bit worried about it being a long approach march, but it didn't concern us other than that we, at that stage, that we were going to have to lug our heavy loads along there.
Who were your commanding officers and what did you think of them?
Well, as I have said previously, my CO was still Dickie DeVoe, Colonel DeVoe, who was a very good soldier. He hadn't had a lot of battle experience, but he was, I think, a basically good soldier. Second in command, Ritson, I don't really know. The company commanders were basically pre-war young regulars. They probably most had left Sandhurst around 36, 37, 38. John Potts of A Company had got the MC in Italy, it was quite good. John Waddy, Baker Company, Somerset Light Infantry, was very good. He eventually became Colonel Commandant of the SAS after the war, having been wounded badly twice. Charlie Company was Jeff Powell, who subsequently wrote the book, which you may or may not have heard, called The Devil's Birthday, and so on. So, no, I think on the whole, and of course we very much revered our brigade commander, Shan Hackett.
Why did you like him so much?
We respected his intelligence, we respected his ability. We had a great respect for him.
How did he treat his subordinates?
Very well. He went to great pains. I can remember at least twice when, having got back to Italy, he had all the officers in the brigade into the Oakham cinema to talk. Once was tactics, anti-tank tactics, firing on reverse slopes and things like that. And he went to great lengths to bring that about. I only personally had one argument with him when, on one of the exercises before D-Day, we were exercising in the south of England, where the hedgerows were rather similar to the Bocage country. It was going to be in Normandy, and we were acting as the enemy. And in order to get my machine guns hitting the enemy on the, who were on a advanced contact roll, I had to get them high, and the only place I could get them high was in a haystack. And I put one gun in the haystack, which I thought as soon as it opened fire on the leading scouts, that would deploy them and hold them up, and that was the right thing to do. And he said, of course, that the hot ammunition cases falling would set the haystack on fire. And I said I disagreed, because I'd have brought doors from the farm, I'd have broken them down in war, and I'd have put the hose on and wetted it down, and we could have got off the belt of ammunition, at which case he pulled rank and said I was to shut up, and that was the end of that. And I still to this day argue with him about that whenever I meet him.
Where did you set off from?
We took off from Saltby Aerodrome, which is in Lincolnshire, and I should explain that my platoon, which was 39 men strong, with the two sections of machine guns, was split into two sticks. My platoon sergeant took one with half the platoon headquarters, which was himself and the range taker, and I took the other half, the other section, with my batman and radio operator. And we took off in these two separate aircraft from Saltby Aerodrome. We left rather late, after about a 2 or 3 hour delay, because there was fog and mist and so on.
And what was the flight like?
Well, the flight for my platoon was catastrophic in a way. First of all, my platoon sergeant's platoon aircraft was hit in the air by flak, and in fact crashed in flames just south of Arnhem. All the men were killed except one. I learnt recently that they were all killed except one, and one was thrown out and broke his back and died that night in a local farmhouse. The men, I can imagine, were as the aircraft went down, were thrown to the front of the aircraft. The pilot apparently did make a reasonable landing, but hit a dike, and which flipped the aircraft over onto its back, and they were all wiped out, the crew and